launch. Feels like a lot, but it's less than 2% of Northrop Grumman's total annual sales. No doubt a freshly minted astrophysicist would be thrilled to work on the Webb telescope itself or on the company's petal-shaped starshade screen, which is designed to fly thousands of miles in front of any space telescope, blocking the light of various stars so that their planetary systems can be studied. Plus, working in industry means a higher salary than a university can offer, so the attraction is strong. But having joined the 67,000 other employees at Northrop Grumman, our starry-eyed scientists might instead be deployed to military-related aerospace projects, radar arrays, multi-spectral high-res imaging, ballistic missile defense, high-energy lasers, EHF, extremely high-frequency protected communications systems, space-based infrared surveillance, maybe even stealth bombers. Space exploration may pull in the talent, but war pays the bills. On April 14, 2003, the day the U.S. military established a seemingly firm hold on the hometown of Saddam Hussein, the director of operations for the Joint Chiefs of Staff said, "I would anticipate the major combat engagements are over. Operation Iraqi Freedom, a 27-day siege, was ending." 2 weeks later, clad in a strappy flight suit and speaking from the flight deck of the aircraft carrier USS Abraham Lincoln at sea near San Diego, California, President Bush echoed the Joint Chiefs' assessment. "In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed. In this battle, we have fought for the cause of liberty and for the peace of the world. With new tactics and precision weapons, we can achieve military objectives without directing violence against civilians. The war on terror is not over, yet it is not endless. We do not know the day of final victory, but we have seen the turning of the tide. No act of the terrorists will change our purpose or weaken our resolve or alter their fate. Their cause is lost. Free nations will press on to victory." Other nations in history have fought in foreign lands and remain to occupy and exploit. Americans, following a battle, want nothing more than to return home. As we now know, the terrorists' cause was not lost, and the United States had not prevailed. Much violence was yet to be directed against civilians, nor was returning home on that year's or that decade's agenda. But occupation was. 3 Aprils later, in 2006, as the third anniversary of Bush's premature declaration approached, I attended another National Space Symposium at the Broadmoor. Conditions in Iraq were dire. Civil strife, almost daily insurgent attacks, the infrastructure still in wreckage, the prospects for a stable and effective national government still teetering despite an encouraging turnout for national elections some 2 months earlier. Many American troops were on their third or fourth tour of duty. Some 100,000 well-paid private contractors supplied by firms such as Halliburton and Blackwater USA were working alongside active duty troops at the rate of almost 1-to-1. U.S. military deaths had exceeded 2,000. Iraqi civilian deaths had exceeded 30,000 by some accounts and 600,000 by others. The official number of U.S. military wounded was nearing 20,000. A half dozen retired generals were about to come out publicly against the Bush administration's handling of the war. And the money was flowing. The direct costs of war in 2006 approached $10 billion a month, while the full costs of war exceeded $15 billion a month. Business boomed at the symposium, with more than 7,000 participants and more than 100 companies and space-related organizations showcasing their wares, sprawled across far more square footage than they had occupied at the exhibit center the previous year. The theme was, "One industry, go for launch," a phrase that suggests the meshing of military, scientific, technological, corporate, and political interests into a unified command structure. A post-conference news release featured a rave review from Elliot Pullum, the Space Foundation's late president and CEO. There was an excitement and sense of industry unity in the air. With the civil, commercial, national security, and entrepreneurial space community all converging from across the nation and around the world, there was a feeling that humanity is poised to take the next bold steps in the greatest adventure of all. Excitement, industry unity, humanity poised for boldness and adventure. But was all of humanity equally poised? Three news releases that appeared in my inbox later that April point to some answers. One was a policy bulletin from the American Institute of Physics about a hearing in late March of the Science, State, Justice, and Commerce Subcommittee of the U.S. House of Representatives. The bulletin summarizes statements by Michael Griffin, then the NASA administrator, on the difficulties of apportioning available funds in a way that would satisfy everyone, and quotes his contention that the capability to put people into space is one of the things that define a nation as a superpower. In other words, mastery in space strongly correlates with mastery on Earth. You don't have to be head of NASA to hold that view, of course. Policymakers in the world's most populous nation think that way, too. In 2003, China became the third nation to send humans into space all on its own. By late 2005, China was regarded as the likeliest imminent superpower by two-thirds of the American electorate. And during the National Space Symposium of April 2006 at the Broadmoor, Griffin's counterpart at the China National Space Administration delivered a quite stunning list of his agency's achievements, projects, and goals to a huge and extremely attentive crowd that looked like the very embodiment of industry unity. Lots of blue uniforms and good suits, with a scattering of low-fashion engineers, except that this crowd seemed to be radiating consternation rather than excitement. Industry unity, by the way, is simply a suaver way of referring to the emergent space industrial complex, akin to the oft-referenced military-industrial complex named by General Dwight D. Eisenhower in his presidential exit speech. Consider, then, the second of my April 2006 emails. In this one, Michael Griffin announces the appointment of Simon P. Pete Warden, a retired U.S. Air Force Brigadier General and research professor of astronomy at the University of Arizona, as the next director of NASA's Ames Research Center in California. Warden is pedigreed, a Ph.D. in astronomy, a past director of the Air Force Space Command, a commander of the 50th Space Wing of the Air Force Space Command, an official with the Strategic Defense Initiative Organization, home of Star Wars, missile defense, and director of the 1994 Clementine Lunar Probe, a collaboration between NASA and the Department of Defense. This is industry unity rolled into a single person, seamless transitions, and frictionless flow between power and war and space science. But there may not be enough Pete Wardens out there to keep the pipeline pumped. Consider the third of my April emails worth sharing. This one, a news release from the University of Arizona, distributed through the news portal of the American Astronomical Society, summarized a survey of U.S.-based planetary scientists' opinions concerning priorities for exploration of the solar system. More than 1,000 people responded, fully half the community, and their view was overwhelmingly that research and analysis are far more important than missions. Also included was commentary from the director of UA's Lunar and Planetary Laboratory, who was worried about something even more basic than basic research. Based on trend lines in American demography, he contended, the real issue is that half of the American workforce will be retired 10 years from now. Half of the workforce means half the astrophysicists, half the accountants, half the pharmacists, teachers, carpenters, journalists, bartenders, fishermen, auto mechanics, apple growers, rocket engineers, everybody. It represents a staggering breadth and depth of expertise. So either the United States ponies up to encourage, educate, support, and utilize current and future scientists, or else U.S. science evaporates, along with all the jobs, breakthroughs, space missions, discoveries, power, and money that flow from it. You can already see that evaporation if you look at the job losses. The termination of the Space Shuttle program had a huge impact. From a high of 32,000 in the 1990s, the shuttle workforce dropped to 6,000 by mid-2011, though some people were fortunate enough to be reassigned. More generally, in terms of the early years of our no longer new century, core employment across America's space industry dropped from a high of 266,700 in 2006 to 216,300 in early 2016. That's a 19% drop in the course of a decade when, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the total non-farm workforce rose by 6%. Despite the slide, drop, slow recovery during 2008 through 2010. The U.S. space employment situation looks even grimmer when contrasted to that in Europe and Japan during the same period. Today, while private, for-profit U.S. companies perfect a space taxi that may replace the shuttle program, our uneasy partner, Russia, ferries America's astronauts to and from the International Space Station for a steep fee, about $71 million per seat for a round trip through 2016, increasing to $82 million under the next contract. Since Russia is, for the time being, the only game in town, that price increase is not a shock, just supply and demand at work. Today, unless they're lucky enough to have been hired there or to have European collaborators, American particle physicists wistfully gaze across the Atlantic Ocean and over the Alps at the Large Hadron Collider near Geneva, Switzerland, the most powerful accelerator ever built, in which controlled conditions that rival the earliest high-energy moments of the Big Bang have yielded evidence of the long-sought subatomic particle called the Higgs boson. They're wistful because Europe's collider is only a fifth as powerful as America's superconducting supercollider would have been had Congress not cut the entire project in 1993, a few short years after peace broke out between the United States and the Soviet Union, a tale worth telling. In the 1970s, astrophysicists came to realize that the dense, hot conditions of the infant universe 14 billion years in the past could be recreated within a particle accelerator. The higher the energy attained by the accelerator, the closer scientists could get to the Big Bang itself. The key to attaining ever higher energies is to generate ever stronger magnetic fields, which accelerate charged particles to stupendously high speeds. The ring of the accelerator becomes a particle racetrack. Slam the particles into one another from opposite directions, and brand new particles are birthed. Some predicted, others unimagined. By the 1980s, The introduction of superconducting materials enabled accelerators to generate significantly stronger magnetic fields and thus even more wildly energetic collisions. Currently, the U.S. Department of Energy controls 17 national science laboratories. Often aligned with universities, some have particle accelerators, each more powerful than its predecessors. Notable labs on this list include Stanford's SLAC National Accelerator Lab in California and the Fermi National Accelerator Lab in Illinois, as well as Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, managed by the University of California, Oak Ridge National Lab, managed by the University of Tennessee, and Brookhaven National Lab in New York, associated with Stony Brook University. These institutions employ bevies of engineers and teams of high-energy particle physicists hunting for the fundamental structure of matter. Has the United States funded and engaged in this kind of research purely for the sake of discovery? Hardly. Most American accelerators were built during the Cold War, when the particle physicist was a vital resource for increasing the lethality of nuclear weapons. That's how astrophysics, specifically astroparticle physics, a branch of cosmology, became an auxiliary beneficiary of Cold War science priorities. Astrophysics and the military are conjoined whether their shared buoy bobs up or down in the tidewaters of politics. In the fall of 1987, past the midway point of his second term, President Ronald Reagan approved construction of the Superconducting Super Collider, SSC, which the chair of the House Science, Space, and Technology Committee called the biggest public works project in the history of the United States. 54 miles in circumference, the SSC needed a big enough state with large swaths of relatively unpopulated areas whose deep-down geology would tolerate tunneling. Texas, specifically the town of Waxahachie, situated above the geological formation known as the Austin Chalk, won the 8-state competition. At 20 times the energy of any previous or planned collider in the world, the SSC would be an engineering marvel, assuring American leadership in particle physics for decades to come. And with an initial price tag of $4.4 billion, it would be the most expensive accelerator ever built. 2 years later, the Berlin Wall came down. 2 years after that, the Soviet Union dissolved. Cold War funding enthusiasm evaporated. By February 1993, the U.S. General Accounting Office had prepared a document for Congress titled simply, Super Collider is over budget and behind schedule. In June 1993, project managers were called in front of the House Subcommittee on Oversight and Investigations not to defend the value of the collider in terms of its contributions to the frontier of physics, but much more important to the members of the subcommittee, to defend it against detailed charges of mismanagement. In peacetime, cost overruns and poor administration were seen as fatal blows to the project, rather than as the normal speed bumps of creating something never before created. Congress's October 1993 decision to cancel funding for the SSC, 2 years after construction began, did not explicitly say, "We won the Cold War, so we don't need physicists and their expensive toys anymore." Rather, the grounds cited were cost overruns and shifting national priorities. Besides, at a comparable price tag, Texas was getting the new space station, headquartered at NASA's Johnson Space Center in Houston. Two major congressionally approved projects in one state during peacetime was a hard sell. Pushed aside during all this oversight were the cosmologists, hidden casualties of peace. Our species' understanding of the greatest explosion ever, the event that created the universe itself, was thwarted because a half-century-long standoff that held humanity hostage to the world's most explosive weapons had ended. Just because America pulls the plug on a scientific project doesn't mean research, planning, and hoping come to a screeching halt elsewhere in the world. Other nations, developed and developing, have begun to pick up where the United States has left off. Leading the way is China, contributing more than 31% between 2000 and 2015 to the growth of worldwide research and development spending, while the United States contributed 19%. Buffed by the ambitions, creativity, and war-inspired innovations of the 20th century, America's high-gloss technological and scientific self-image blinds us to the Dorian Gray reality of our times. Hierarchies have been reordered before. It's happened in art, in commerce, in exploration, in sports. Why shouldn't it happen in space? Some commentators presume it's already happened, and that henceforth America will aim no higher than the creation and aggressive marketing of minor consumer products that replace similar and perfectly satisfactory consumer products. America may be losing a competitive edge in many enterprises, from cars to space, riffed National Public Radio host Scott Simon in the summer of 2010. But as long as we can devise a five-bladed mineral oil-saturated razor, we face the future well-shaved. That the United States could someday be a secondary supplicant nation begging for a seat at Europe's or China's decision table is not the America that most Americans want. To the patriot, the thought is repellent. To the policymaker, it's frightening. To the student, it's deflating. The February 2001 report of the Hart-Rudman Commission on National Security, for instance, minces no words on the matter. Second only to a weapon of mass destruction detonating in an American city, we can think of nothing more dangerous than a failure to manage properly science, technology, and education for the common good over the next quarter century. America's international reputation, and therefore a significant aspect of its global influence, depends on its reputation for excellence in these areas. U.S. performance is not keeping up with its reputation. Other countries are striving hard, and with discipline, they will outstrip us. This is not a matter merely of national pride or international image. It is an issue of fundamental importance to national security. Complacency with our current achievement of national wealth and international power will put all of this at risk. Half a decade later, the Competitiveness Index, Where America Stands, a 20-year overview published by the Council on Competitiveness, also sounded the alarm. While noting America's position as the world's largest economy and its responsibility for one-third of global economic growth from 1986 to 2005, among other achievements, the report marshals reams of statistics showing that the future might not be so bright as the past. America still leads the world in science and technology, but that lead is narrowing, reads one heading. Underneath it, bar graphs track the two-decade decline in the U.S. share of total global activity in many categories, ranging from degrees awarded in science and engineering, a 10-point drop in bachelor's degrees, a 30-point drop in doctoral degrees, to the 12-point drop in scientific researchers. As for the prospect of enduring American dominance in space, Joan Johnson Fries, professor of national security studies at the U.S. Naval War College, foresees only uncertainty. There is no magic solution, no sudden discovery of warp drives or phaser beams or ion cannons that will get us to such a secure future. No question. America's space program has had some major recent successes, but so have the space programs of China, India, Canada, and South Korea. The European Space Agency, Russia's Roscosmos, and Japan's JAXA are central to the collective space endeavor. Space programs have been operating for several decades in Azerbaijan, Bulgaria, Egypt, Israel, Indonesia, North Korea, Pakistan, Peru, Turkey, Uruguay, and most countries in Western Europe. Bahrain, Bolivia, Costa Rica, Mexico, New Zealand, Poland, South Africa, Turkmenistan, and the United Arab Emirates joined the list during the second decade of the current century. Australia and Sri Lanka will soon join as well. Altogether, there are now more than 70 government-run space agencies. Some 4 dozen countries operate satellites. More than a dozen have launch facilities. Intensive and successful, the Chinese space program is readily comparable to those of the United States and the Soviet Union in their better years. On January 11, 2007, when it sent a kinetic kill vehicle more than 800 kilometers into space to destroy one of its own aged weather satellites in a direct hit, China, in effect, announced its status as a space power with potentially lethal capabilities. It could now deny another country freedom of operation in space. The hit put tens of thousands of long-lived fragments into high Earth orbit, adding to the already considerable dangers posed by debris previously generated by other countries, notably ours. China was roundly criticized by other space-faring nations for making such a mess. 12 days later, its foreign ministry declared that the action was not directed at any country and does not constitute a threat to any country. That's a little like saying the Soviet Union's launch of the world's first satellite, Sputnik, in October 1957, was not a threat, even though Sputnik's booster rocket was an intercontinental ballistic missile, even though Cold Warriors had been thirsting for a space-based reconnaissance vehicle since the end of World War II, even though post-war Soviet rocket research had been focusing on the delivery of a nuclear bomb across the Pacific, and even though Sputnik's peacefully pulsing radio transmitter was sitting where a nuclear warhead would otherwise have been. Of course, among the many implications of China's successful kill, one seemed unmissable. A U.S. spy satellite, or a bit of U.S. missile defense hardware orbiting at the same altitude, could just as easily have been the target. General T. Michael Mosley, the U.S. Air Force Chief of Staff, called the Chinese achievement a strategically dislocating event. If you can hit a 6-foot-long object at 500 miles, he said, you can certainly hit something out beyond 20,000 miles. It's just a physics problem. Since then, space has only become more crowded, militarized, and globalized. More dislocation seems inevitable, and more cooperation essential. Nearly 3,000 years ago, architects, stonemasons, sculptors, and slaves built a breathtaking palace complex for the Assyrian ruler Ashurnasirpal II, in the ancient city of Kalu, some 300 kilometers north of modern-day Baghdad. Wall panels from the Northwest Palace now hang in the British Museum in London and the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City. Carved in bas-relief on the panels are muscled archers, charging chariots, stricken lions, supplicants bearing tribute, and other iterations of victory. Across the center of each panel in the British Museum runs a cuneiform text, the so-called standard inscription of Ashurnasirpal, proclaiming the ruler's invincibility. The great king, the mighty king, king of Assyria, the valiant man who acts with the support of Ashur, his lord, and has no equal among the princes of the four quarters of the world. the king who makes those who are not subject to him submissive, who has subjugated all mankind, the mighty warrior who treads on the neck of his enemies, tramples down all foes, and shatters the forces of the proud, the king who acts with the support of the great gods, and whose hand has conquered all lands, who has subjugated all the mountains and received their tribute, taking hostages and establishing his power over all countries. Invincibility does have its limits, however. Ashurnazirpal II's kin ruled northern Mesopotamia for 2 centuries. The Assyrian Empire and the great palaces at Kalu, later called Nimrud, endured for 1 century more. Today, Nimrud's glory exists only within the walls of Western museums. In 2007, with the onset of the U.S. troop surge, the Iraqi city of Mosul, Nimrud's nearest neighbor, became a place where gunmen would fire on a wedding procession and 9 unidentified bodies could be delivered to the morgue in a single day. In 2014, with the advance of the Islamic State of Iraq and Greater Syria, Mosul became a ruin from which the inhabitants had to flee and where the U.S.-trained Iraqi army scattered like powder in the wind. By July 2017, when Iraq's prime minister arrived in the broken city to declare victory over ISIS, New York Times headlines were announcing civilians emerged from Mosul's rubble, starving, injured, and traumatized, and basic infrastructure repair in Mosul will cost over $1 billion, UN. And the archaeological treasures that ISIS had not already looted had mostly been smashed to bits. The praise of Ashurnazirpal was praise of empire. The inscription paints him as an uncommanded commander, to borrow a phrase from John Horace Parry, the distinguished British historian of European empire. In 1971, Parry noted that in the second half of the 20th century, some major Western states, notably the United States of America, whose political traditions included a profound suspicion of imperialism, found themselves drawn with much misgiving into widespread ventures and responsibilities of a quasi-imperial kind. Yet as the century drew to a close, many political thinkers and commanders relinquished their misgivings, in effect dropping the quasi from imperial. They acquired the habit of proclaiming America's capacity to subjugate its foes on Earth and broadcasting its intentions to suppress them in space. Parry might have applied the word dominion, the original meaning of imperium. Today it is mostly fantasists who praise empire and video gamers who hunger for it. The late American political essayist and novelist Gore Vidal, a witty lefty patrician, made American empire a prime target, evidenced in titles such as The Last Empire, 2001, and Imperial America, Reflections of the United States of Amnesia, 2004. The late political scientist Chalmers Johnson, an East Asia specialist who gave us the useful term blowback, is another writer whose works evinced disillusionment with the course of U.S. foreign policy. The Sorrows of Empire, 2004. Dismantling the Empire, 2010. J.M. Coetzee, a South African writer who won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 2003, presented an especially tragic view of empire in his 1980 novel, Waiting for the Barbarians. Near the end of the novel, the main character, a discredited petty functionary who once oversaw a nameless walled outpost, accuses empire of preoccupation with a single thought, how not to end, how not to die, how to prolong its era. In a less literary portrayal of the workings of empire, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ron Suskind recounted his meeting in 2002 with a senior advisor to George W. Bush, who upbraided the author for a recent article and then dismissed his work in a way that, as Suskind realized only later, captured the very heart of the Bush presidency. The Age said that guys like me were in what we call the reality-based community, which he defined as people who believe that solutions emerge from your judicious study of discernible reality. I nodded and murmured something about enlightenment principles and empiricism. He cut me off. "That's not the way the world really works anymore," he continued. "We're an empire now, and when we act, we create our own reality. And while you're studying that reality, judiciously as you will, we'll act again, creating other new realities, which you can study too, and that's how things will sort out. We're history's actors, and you, all of you, will be left to just study what we do." Despite the bluster, Americans might be going the way of the Assyrians, not to speak of the Romans or the Maya or the Ottomans. By the end of the 21st century's opening decade, references to the disappearing American empire had become commonplace in platforms across much of the political spectrum. New York Times op-ed columnist Maureen Dowd colorfully observed on October 11, 2008, following the Dow's worst week of its life till then, "With modernity crumbling, our thoughts turn to antiquity. The decline and fall of the American empire echoes the experience of the Romans, who also tumbled into the trap of becoming over-leveraged empire hussies." Long before the word empire began popping up in the Times, journalists, scholars, Baghdad bureau chiefs, former CIA higher-ups, counterterrorism experts, historians, and political commentators of every stripe began to sprinkle their writing and their titles with it, occasionally linking it with hubris. So pervasive had these terms become that in mid-2008, a Yahoo stock blog depicted investors as wondering if the dollar's swoon signals a much longer-term displacing of the global American empire, and proposed portfolio adjustments for the end of the American empire. What does it take to build an empire? What resources must be consumed to sustain one? Why do some people hunger for power while others shun it? What nations, if any, must be inculcated or invaded by other nations to achieve security, real or imagined? Which people, if any, must be placated or silenced to prevent uprisings? What must get broken and who must get killed to achieve these ends? Centuries ago, Christian Huygens contended that war and commerce had forced out most of those discoveries of which we are masters, and almost all the secrets in experimental knowledge. With only rare exceptions, history shows that while strategy and bravery can win a battle, the frontiers of science and technology must be exploited to win a war. Though the night sky itself is the quintessential frontier, the astrophysicist neither declares war nor makes international enemies. Countries manage that with no help from scientists. Yet for every empire the world has known, sky watchers have been in attendance, offering arcane cosmic knowledge that has been enabled by and has also reinforced the power wielded by leaders. Leaders who sought the highest ground and judged, once again, that it was time to kill. Chapter 2. Star Power. Throughout much of history, knowledge of the heavens informed the rhythms of life and the mastery of territory. Astronomy moved arm in arm with agriculture, trade, migration, empire, and war. It created and marked time. It registered place on Earth. It was both a sacred mystery and a blue-chip stock. Astronomers wielded power and served the powerful. Millennia before anybody had drawn usable maps of the continents, people memorized imagined maps of the sky. long before there were astrolabes or sextants or precision portable clocks to establish distance, latitude, and longitude, people gauged their position with no tools but their eyes and the sky. To go where no one had gone before, to know how long it took to get there, and to return there if you liked what you found, you needed guides. The sky was a good one, especially if your path lay across uncharted ocean, unstable dunes, sweeping grasslands, or barren tundra. Heaven itself was both compass and clock, direction finder and timekeeper. For many, it was also ultimate cause, crystal ball, and the home of deities, astronomy, astrology, history, folklore, religion, psychology, and poetry rolled into one. Knowing the rhythms of the sky was a means to knowing the character and fate of all things. It's anybody's guess when and where a community chronicler, or maybe an insomniac, first decided to track the cycles of change in the moon's illuminated disk, or the alternate lengthening and shortening of the sun's arc across the sky, or the periodic comings and goings of Venus. Such tracking would have predated the first stone tools. Maybe an antecedent of Homo sapiens was the first to do it. Whoever it was and whenever it happened, that signaled the birth of astronomy, a source of both wonder and power for our nascent species. Consider units of time. If the sun never set, and the moon never waned, our measures of time might be grounded solely in biology, the beating heart, circadian rhythms, menstruation, because periodicity is part of who we are. But the sun does set, and the moon predictably waxes and wanes. Transitions recur endlessly in the skies above. Celestial cycles offer themselves as a natural measure of time in units we care about. Earth's early cultures, population centers, and central governments required official methods of organizing time, especially when they needed to plan ahead. Sacrifices, festivals, planting, harvesting, tax collection, daily work shifts, and daily prayers took place at predictable intervals. In Upper Egypt, farmers needed to know when the dazzling dog star, Sirius, the brightest star in the night sky, would appear in the dawn sky just before the rising sun, because that was when the Nile, too, would be rising. Hunters, gatherers, herders, and nomads also required advanced planning. Their lives depended on knowing when the regional water holes would dry up, when the cattle, or gazelles, or bison, would give birth and the eggs of the Mali hen could be stolen, when to visit the wild strawberry patches, and when to dig up the yams. It was useful to know how many days' travel were needed to reach the nearest oasis. It was useful to monitor fertility. Everybody needed ways to track the passing days. More than 20,000 years ago, people made notches in animal bones and painted rows of dots on the walls of caves to mark the days of a lunar cycle. But no round number of lunar cycles matches the duration of the solar year, a discrepancy that gave rise to continual fussing with calendars. Several early cultures followed a 12-month year. Some added the occasional 13th month or 5-day block to keep things on track. Discrepancies notwithstanding, sometime around the middle of the 5th millennium B.C., the Egyptians counted the correct round number of whole days in a year. They also devised a 365-day solar calendar that began with the rising of Sirius on July 19, 4236 B.C., possibly the earliest secure date in history. Unlike the solar day, the lunar month, the Earth year, or the other celestial cycles that our ancestors could observe, subunits of time, such as the hour, the minute, and the second, are a matter of cultural and mathematical taste. Sociologically, they suggest the emergence of oversight, labor, standardization, and penalty. Slaves and prisoners on construction gangs, priests reciting prayers at fixed intervals, sentries posted for a fixed watch, and more recently, trains running on time, workers punching in, and spacecraft systems synchronized for launch. On a more personal level, they suggest practicalities and annoyances, such as waiting for the bread to finish baking or your mate to return home. Enter the clock, whether based on a moving shadow, the obelisk or sundial, flowing water, the clepsydra, an advancing gear, a swinging pendulum, or a transitioning electron in an atom of cesium. The Sumerians divided the day into twelfths, and each twelfth into thirtieths. The Egyptians divided both day and night into twelfths. Voila, the 24-hour day. The Babylonians came up with the fraction-friendly 60-minute hour and 60-second minute. But not all units of time are as practical as the minute or the month. Plato, for instance, wrote of the perfect year, the period necessary for all the planets to return to their initial configuration. A scheme devised by the ancient Hindus employs even vaster units, such as the kalpa, the length of a single day or single night in the lifetime of Brahma, who dreams the universe into existence each time he sleeps. When he awakes, the universe begins anew. 4.32 billion years later, when he next falls asleep, it vanishes. The Maya, too, formulated an overview of time based on attenuated cycles of creation. The most recent cycle, expressed through their complicated long count, began on August 12, 3114 BC. Nor did such imaginative conceptions cease in the modern world. A mystical quasi-mentor of Adolf Hitler's, for instance, foretold that the 730-year cosmic week beginning in 1920 would, because of Jupiter's entrance into Pisces, bring about the millenarian triumph of blonde Christians under the wise and genial rule of aristocrats, priests, and führers. Besides marking time, there was the challenge of mapping the sky. If heaven was the fount of fortune and disaster, prudence demanded that the stars and the constellations they trace be demarcated and monitored. Some early Chinese astronomers divided the sky into the five palaces. Others divided it into the nine fields, or the 12 earthly branches, or the 28 lunar mansions. Early Mesopotamian astronomers divided the eastern horizon into the paths of three gods, with 60 fixed stars and constellations rising within the paths. Later Mesopotamian, Babylonian, astronomers divided the sky into 12 segments, each associated with a constellation and each enclosing 30 degrees of the sun's year-long path across the sky, forming the now classic 12 constellations of the Western Zodiac. Inevitably, references to the cosmos show up in the art and architecture of antiquity. Cuneiform tablets inscribed 5,000 years ago in Mesopotamia mentioned the bull, Taurus, the lion, Leo, and the scorpion, Scorpio. A tablet inscribed almost 4,000 years ago in the Mesopotamian city of Nineveh lists the apparitions of Venus during the reign of King Amasataka. The arched ceiling of a 1st century BC Han Dynasty tomb unearthed on the campus of Jiaotong University in Xi'an, China, presents a painted diagram of the heavens showing the sun and the moon surrounded by a circular band filled with symbolic figures representing the 28 lunar lodges that mark the path of the moon. Scattered across our planet are enormous stone temple ruins and looming stone monuments whose structure reveals well-established knowledge of sky patterns. In the ancient world, architecture, owing in part to the expense, labor, and time necessary for its construction, was the very embodiment of state and religious power. Among the oldest undisputed monuments with a celestial tinge are the 4th millennium B.C. stone passage tombs of County Meath, Ireland, low burial mounds where at the winter solstice sunlight streams through an opening above the entrance and illuminates a long passageway leading to a large chamber. Doorways and sight lines of massive stoneworks, whose many-ton components were in some cases quarried, transported, shaped, and positioned without the aid of metal tools, aligned perhaps not precisely but still convincingly with the rising or setting sun at the spring equinox or winter solstice, the setting full moon at the summer solstice, the cardinal directions, or the apparitions of a planet, or the never-setting pole star. The slew of far-flung examples include the pyramids at Giza, stone circles throughout the British Isles, roofed temple complexes in Malta, octagons in the Basque region, the caracol at Chichen Itza, the Templo Mayor in Mexico City, and the 13 towers at Chanquillo, Peru, which consists of a row of towers strung across a ridge plus two observation structures, one to the west and one to the east. Other, more modest constructions embody the same principles. At Nabta Playa in southern Egypt, two upright stone gates in a small circle of sandstone slabs akin to a small Stonehenge align with what would have been the position of the rising sun at summer solstice. In fits and starts, astronomy became a science. During the first millennium B.C., the astronomers of Mesopotamia and China, in the service of hereditary rulers, warrior kings, and eminent priests, compiled systematic records of what happened before their eyes and developed systems and even instruments for predicting what would happen in the future. About 1,500 late Babylonian clay tablets in the form of diaries chronicling routine observations have been found to date. Spanning 8 centuries, the tablets list such things as lunar eclipses, weather conditions, intervals between moonrise and sunrise, and between sunset and moonset at different times of each month, and the changing positions of the planets in relation to 31 reference stars. By about 500 B.C., Babylonian astronomers had devised mathematical ways of predicting the dates of new and full moons. The world's earliest known record of a series of solar eclipses between about 720 and 480 B.C. comes from China. By 200 B.C., Chinese court astronomers had begun to chronicle most celestial phenomena visible to the unaided eye, both cyclic and episodic, whether or not they understood what they saw. Auroras, comets, meteors, sunspots, novas, and supernovas, as well as the paths of planets month by month. The presumed relationship between the unfolding universe above and the affairs of state below rendered this record-keeping a guarded activity. In today's parlance, it was classified research. When I was a postdoc at Princeton University in the early 1990s, a graduate student specializing in ancient Chinese culture stopped by my office with a query about a certain historical date. Sometime around 1950 BC, he couldn't pinpoint the year. Major events had taken place in China, and he suspected that some kind of sky event had preceded them. He was right. Whipping out my planetarium sky search software, I discovered that February 26, 1953 BC corresponded with the tightest conjunction of planets ever witnessed by civilization. Mercury, Venus, Mars, and Saturn gathered on the sky within half the area of your pinky fingernail held at arm's length, half a degree. With Jupiter 2 finger widths away, 4.5 degrees, creating a conjunction of all five known planets. 4 days later, the very thin, waning crescent moon would join the jamboree. All six objects were now nicely contained within the top-to-bottom area of your fist at arm's length, 10 degrees. Other spacenicks with equal access to computational tools would independently discover this alignment. Although uncertainties abound when you're trying to date events from early history, it turns out that 1953 BC just may coincide with the founding of the Shah dynasty by its first ruler, Yu, of whom it was recorded in the Shaojing Guoming Jue. At the time of Yu, the planets were stacked like strung pearls. More important, the 1st century BC Hong Fan Juan, account of the Great Plan, now lost, declared that a new calendar began on a spring morning in about 2000 BC during a five-planet conjunction with the new moon, all of which makes the February 1953 BC conjunction a convincing candidate for the start date of what became the modern Chinese calendar. While the Chinese were occupied in observing and recording the behavior of objects, the Greeks were expanding astronomy's reach, making it both more conceptual, more practical, and more accessible. Empowered by geometry, they began to measure and map the universe as no civilization had done before. Triangulation, an idea set down in Euclid's Elements, circa 300 BC, as a pure mathematical statement, proved useful for estimating the distance between Earth and the Sun. Several centuries after Elements hit the market, an expert toolmaker, perhaps on the island of Rhodes, likely in collaboration with an astronomer, built a sophisticated calendar, astronomical computer, almanac, planetarium, known today as the Antikythera mechanism, perhaps the most debated scientific object from the ancient world. Alexander Jones, a classicist and historian of the mathematical sciences, proposes that the Antikythera mechanism be called a cosmochronicon, found along with other high-end cargo in a large Mediterranean shipwreck at a depth of 180 feet and fitted with dozens of bronze gear wheels, a hand crank, multiple dials, and multiple inscriptions. It was a shoebox-sized creation that could calculate the phases of the moon, the changing longitudes of the sun, moon, and planets, the timing of eclipses, solstices, and equinoxes, and several long-term time cycles. Investigators derive its date most likely 1st century BC, and certainly no later than 1st century AD, from such factors as the Hellenistic era vocabulary and lettering in the inscriptions, the state of astronomical knowledge incorporated in the object, and the scores of coins found nearby in the wreck. Though almost shocking in its sophistication, the mechanism does have several known antecedents. It also has a cultural context. Astronomy was treated as a topic suitable for popularization. Think cosmos and star talk, rather than the guarded cosmic secrets of ancient imperial China. And both public and private spaces in the Mediterranean world were liberally sprinkled with astronomy-related objects, such as sundials, large and small, armillary spheres, star globes, and stone tablets called parapegma, which had movable pegs that fit into holes beside each numbered day and served as public almanacs. The Antikythera mechanism, whose complex inner workings have recently been revealed through X-ray computer tomography, CT, and whose surface details have become more legible through reflectance imaging, strikingly exemplifies the Greek concept of uniformly flowing time that could be measured on instruments. Physics, too, now came to the fore. Ever since the 2nd century BC, writers have been recounting the story of the Greek mathematician and military inventor Archimedes, who, they say, devised a burning mirror in about the year 213 to redirect and focus the sun's rays onto a fleet of Roman ships anchored in the harbor of Syracuse, thereby, in the words of Lucian, setting ablaze the triremes of the enemy through art. But even before Archimedes did or didn't do it, mathematicians and engineers had begun to consider what a workable burning mirror would look like. The earliest detailed analyses concluded it would have to be concave,